Letter from Lhasa by Tuesday, Lobsang Rampa. Read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC, May 2017. Chapter 10, How to Breathe. The Japanese guards were in a bad mood again. Officers and men strode about the place scowling, striking at any unfortunate who happened to meet their gaze. We were glum indeed as we contemplated another day of terror, another day of food shortage and useless tasks. Hours before, there had been a swirl of dust as a large captured American car pulled up with a jerk that would have torn the hearts of its makers. There were shouts and yells and men running, buttoning their shabby uniforms. Guards rushed by, grabbing any bit of equipment they could lay their hands on to make some sort of a show to indicate that they were efficient and doing their work. It was a surprise visit from one of the generals commanding the area. Quite definitely it was a surprise. No one had even contemplated another inspection because there had only been one just 2 days before. It seemed that sometimes in the camp the Japanese would call an inspection just to look over the women and to have parties. They would line up the women and examine them and pick out the ones that they wanted, and these would be marched off under armed guard, and a little later we would hear anguish shrieks and cries of terror or pain. This time, though, it was the real thing, a genuine inspection. An inspection by a high-ranking general straight from Japan who had come to see what was really happening in the camps. We found out later that the Japanese had been having a few setbacks, and it occurred to someone that if there were too many atrocities, there may be retributions for a few officials later. At last, the guards were in a more or less straight line, ready for inspection. There was much shuffling, and clouds of dust were rising from the feet of the frightened men. We watched from behind our wire, interested because this time the guards were being inspected and not the prisoners. For a long time the men were being lined up, and then, at last, there was an impression of tenseness, an impression that something was going to happen. As we watched, we saw movements at the guardhouse, men presenting arms. Then the general came out, swaggering along, and strutted down the line of men with his long samurai sword trailing behind him. His face was distorted with rage at having been kept waiting, and his aides were all looking nervous and ill at ease. Slowly he went down the lines of men, picking out one here or there with whom to find fault. Nothing seemed to be light that day. Things were looking blacker and blacker. The little sons of heaven were indeed a sorry-looking crew. In the hurry, they picked up any equipment available, no matter how unsuitable. They had lost their heads completely. They just had to show they were doing something instead of lounging about wasting time. The general moved on and then came to a sudden halt with a screech of rage. One man had a prisoner's drain clearing pole with a tin on the end instead of his rifle. Sometime before, one of the prisoners had been using that pole and that tin to clear out our camp drains. The general looked at the man and looked at the pole and raised his head higher to look at the can at the end of the pole. He became more and more furious. He became quite inarticulate for a moment with rage. Already he had raised himself to his toes and given hard right and left face slaps to a number of men who had incurred his displeasure. Now, at the sight of this drain-clearing pole, he was completely overcome. Eventually, he gained the power of movement. He jumped with rage, then looked about him for something with which to strike the man. A thought occurred to him. He looked down, unhooked his sword and scabbard, and brought that ornamental weapon down on the unfortunate guard's head with stunning force. The poor wretch buckled at the knees and just dropped flat on the ground. Blood poured out of his nostrils and out of his ears. The general contemptuously kicked him and motioned to the guards. The unfortunate man was picked up by his feet and trailed along the ground, his head bumping and bumping. At last he disappeared from our sight, and he was not seen again in our camp. Nothing at all seemed to go right with that inspection. The general and his accompanying officers found fault everywhere. They were turning a peculiar purple with rage. They carried out one inspection, and then they carried out another. We had never seen anything like it. But there was one bright spot from our point of view. The general was so irate with the guards that he forgot to inspect the prisoners. At last, the high-ranking officers disappeared again into the guard room, from whence came shouts of rage and a shot or two. Then they came out again, climbed into their cars, and disappeared from our sight. The guards were given the orders to fall out, and they dispersed, still shaking with fright. So, the Japanese guards were in a very bad mood. They had just beaten up a Dutch woman because she was large and towered over them, and so made them feel inferior. As they said, she was taller than they, and that was an insult to their emperor. She was knocked down with the butt of a rifle and kicked and prodded so that she was injured internally and bleeding. For another hour or two until sunset, she would have to remain on the ground outside the guard room at the main entrance. She would have to remain kneeling on the ground, kneeling with the blood pouring out her. No one, no matter how ill, could be moved before the guards gave permission. If a prisoner died, well, that was one less to feed. Certainly, the guards did not mind in the least, and die she did. Just before sunset, she toppled over. No one could go to her aid. At last, a guard motioned to two prisoners to come and drag the body away. They brought her to me, but it was useless. She was dead. She had bled to death. It was difficult indeed treating patients under camp conditions. We lacked all supplies. Now our bandages were finished. They had been washed and washed and used until they had rotted away, until the last few threads had failed to hang together. We could not make any more from clothing because no one had any to spare. Some of the prisoners, indeed, had no clothing at all. The matter was becoming quite acute. We had so many sores, so many wounds, and no method of treating them. In Tibet, I had studied herbs, and on one of our work expeditions beyond the confines of the camp, I had found a local plant that seemed quite familiar to me. It was wide, with thick leaves, and it was a very useful astringent, a thing that we desperately needed. The problem was to get a supply of these leaves into camp. A group of us talked it over long into the night. Eventually, it was decided that working parties must collect them somehow and hide them in some unspecified manner when they were returning to camp. We discussed how they could be hidden. At last, some really wise person suggested that there was a working party collecting large bamboos. Leaves could be hidden in the stems. Women, or girls, as they called themselves, no matter their age, collected large quantities of fleshy leaves. I was delighted to see them. It was like greeting old friends. We spread all the leaves on the ground behind the huts. The Japanese guards looked on, not at all worried about what we were doing. They thought that we had gone off our heads or something, but we had to spread the leaves so that they could be sorted carefully, because all kinds had been brought in by the women, who were not used to picking one particular plant, and only the one variety could be used. We picked over the leaves and sorted out the one type that we wanted. The rest, well, we had to get rid of those as well, and we spread them upon the pile of dead at the edge of our compound. The leaves left were sorted into large and small, and carefully cleaned from the dirt on them. We had no water which to wash them, because water was a very scarce commodity. Now we had to find a suitable container with which to mash the leaves. The camp rice bowl was the largest thing available, so we took that and put the carefully picked leaves in it. The next worry was finding a suitable stone, one with sharp points on it, so that the leaves could be macerated and made into a fine pulp. Eventually, we were able to find a stone such as we required. It was a stone requiring two hands to lift it. The women who were helping me took it in turns to stir and pound the leaves until they were reduced to a sticky green dough. Our next problem was to find something to absorb blood and pus while the astringent was acting, and something to hold the mass together. Bamboo is a plant of many uses. We decided to put that plant to yet another use. From old canes and waste wood material, we scraped a pith and dried it over a fire in tins. When quite dry, it became as fine as flour and more absorbent than cotton wool. Half bamboo pith and half mashed leaves made a highly satisfactory mixture. Unfortunately, it was friable and fell to pieces at a touch. The construction of a base on which to lay the compound was not easy. We had to shred the outer fibers off the young green bamboo shoots and tease them apart carefully so that we obtained the longest possible threads. These we laid on a thoroughly scrubbed metal sheet, which normally protected the floor from the fire. We laid the fibers on lengthwise and crisscross, as if we were weaving, as if we were making a long, narrow carpet. Eventually, after much toil, we had an untidy-looking net, about 8 feet long and 2 feet wide. With a rolling pin made of large-diameter bamboo, we forced the leaf and the pith mixture into the network, pushing it in so that all the strands of the bamboo were converted, till we had a fairly even filling of our mashed mixture. Then we turned it over and did the same thing with the other side. When we finished, we had a pale green dressing with which to staunch the flow of blood and promote healing. It had been something like papermaking, and the finished result was similar to thick green cardboard, pliable, not easily bent, indeed not easily cut with the crude implement which we had at our disposal. But eventually we did manage to cut the material into strips about 4 inches wide, and then we peeled them from the metal plate to which they had been adhering. In their present state, they would keep and remain flexible for many weeks. We found them a blessing indeed. One day, a woman who had been working with the Japanese canteen pretended that she was ill. She came to me in a state of great excitement. She'd been cleaning out a storeroom containing much equipment captured from the Americans. Somehow she had knocked over a tin from which the label had fallen, and some red-brown crystals had poured out. Idly, she had poked her fingers into them, stirring them around, wondering what they were. Later, on putting her hands into water to continue scrubbing, she had found ginger-brown stains on her hand. Was she poisoned? Was it a trap of the Japanese? She had decided that she'd better come to me in a hurry. I looked at her hands, I sniffed them, and then, if I had been emotional, I should have jumped for joy. It was obvious to me what caused the stains. Permanganate of potash crystals. Just the thing we needed for our many tropical ulcer cases. I said, "Nina, you get that tin out somehow. Fix the lid on and put the tin in a bucket, but get it here and keep it dry." She returned to the canteen absolutely bubbling over with joy to think that she had been responsible for discovering something which would alleviate a little of the suffering. Later in the day, she returned and produced a tin of crystals, and a few days later she produced another and yet another tin. We blessed the Americans that day. We even blessed the Japanese for capturing the American supplies. Tropical ulcers are dreadful things. Lack of adequate food and neglect are the main causes. It may be that the inability to have a good wash contributes toward it. First, there is a slight itch, and the victim absent-mindedly scratches. Then, a small pimple like a red pinhead appears, and it is scratched or dug with exasperation. Infection from the fingernails gets into the abrasion. Gradually, the whole area becomes red, an angry red. Little yellow nodules form beneath the skin and cause further irritation and more severe scratching. the ulcer would grow outwards and outwards. Pus, evil-smelling stuff, would appear. In course of time, the body resources would become further depleted, and the health would deteriorate even more. Down and down would grow the ulcer, eating through the flesh, through the cartilage, and eventually through the bone, killing the marrow and the tissue. If nothing was done, the patient would eventually die. But something had to be done. The ulcer, the source of the infection, had to be removed somehow and as quickly as possible. Lacking all medical equipment, we had to resort to truly desperate measures. The ulcer had to be removed to save the life of the patient. The whole thing had to be lifted out. So, there was only one thing for it. We made a scoop from a tin and carefully sharpened the edge. Then, sterilized the tin the best way we could over the flame of our fire. Fellow prisoners held the affected limb of the sufferer, and with the sharpened tin, I could scoop out the dead flesh and the pus until only healthy tissue was left. We had to be quite sure that there was no spot of infection overlooked and left behind, or the ulcer would grow again like a malignant weed. With the tissue cleaned out of the ulcer's ravages, the large cavity would be filled with the herbal paste, and with infinite care the patient would be nursed back to health, health as measured by our camp standard. And that standard would be almost death anywhere else. The permanganate of potash would help the healing process by assisting in keeping down pus and other sources of infection. We treated it like gold dust. So, our treatment sounds brutal? It was. But our brutal methods save many a life, and many a limb, too. Without such treatment, the ulcer would grow and grow, poisoning the system, so that eventually the arm or leg had to be amputated without anesthetics to save the life of the sufferer. Health was indeed a problem in our camp. The Japanese gave us no assistance of any kind, so in the end I drew upon my knowledge of breathing and taught many of those in the camp special breathing for special purposes, because by breathing correctly, breathing to certain rhythms, one can do much to improve the health both mentally and physically. My guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, taught me the science of breathing after he had caught me one day panting up a hill, almost collapsing with exhaustion. "Lobsang, Lobsang," he said, "what have you been doing to yourself in that horrible state?" "Honorable Master," I replied gaspingly, "I have been trying to walk up the hill on stilts." He looked at me sadly and shook his head with an air of sad resignation. He sighed and motioned for me to sit down. For a time there was silence between us. Silence, that is, except for the rasping of my breath as I strove to get back to normalcy. I had been walking about down near the Lingor Road on stilts, showing off to the pilgrims. showing off by boasting how the monks of Shakyamuni could walk better and further and faster on stilts than anyone else in Lhasa. To prove the matter even more conclusively, I had turned and run on stilts up the hill. As soon as I had managed to turn the first bend and was out of sight of the pilgrims, I had fallen off with sheer exhaustion. And just after, my guide had come along and seen me in that sorry plight. Lobsang, it is indeed time that you learned some more. There has been enough play, enough sport. Now, as you have so clearly demonstrated, you are in need of instruction on the science of correct breathing. Come with me. We will see what we can do to remedy that state of affairs. He rose to his feet and led the way up the hill. I rose reluctantly, picked up my stilts which had fallen askew, and followed him. He strode on easily, seeming to glide. There was no effort in his movement at all, and I, many years younger, struggled on after him, panting away like a dog on a hot summer's day. At the top of the hill, we turned into the enclosure of our lamasery, and I followed my guide to his room. Inside, we seated ourselves on the floor in the usual way, and the lama rang for the inevitable tea without which no Tibetan can carry on a serious discussion. We kept silence while the serving monks came in with tea and sampa, and then as they left, the Lama poured out the tea and gave me my first instruction on the art of breathing, instruction which was to be invaluable to me in this prison camp. You are puffing and panting away like an old man, Lobsang, he said. I will soon teach you to overcome that, because no one should work so hard at what is an ordinary, natural, everyday occurrence. Too many people neglect breathing. They think you just take in a load of air and expel that load of air and take in another. But, Honorable Master, I replied, I have been able to breathe quite nicely for 9 years or more. How else can I breathe but the way in which I have always managed? Lobsang, you must remember that breath is indeed the source of life. You can walk and you can run, but without breath you can do neither. You must learn a new system, and first of all you must take a standard of time in which to breathe, because until you know this standard of time, there is no way in which you can apportion the various ratios of time to your breathing. And we breathe at different rates for different purposes. He took my left wrist and pointed out a spot, saying, take your heart, your pulse. Your pulse goes in the rhythm of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Put your finger on your pulse yourself and feel, and then you will understand what I'm talking about. I did so. I put a finger on my left wrist and felt my pulse rate as he said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I looked up at my guide as he continued. If you think about it, you will find that you breathe in air for as long as your heart takes to beat 6 times, but that is not good enough. You will have to be able to vary that breathing quite a lot, and we will deal with that in a few moments. He paused and looked at me and then said, "Do you know, Lobsang, you boys, I've been watching you at play. You get yourselves really exhausted because you do not know the first thing about breathing. You think that as long as you take in air and let out air, that is all that matters. But you could not be more incorrect. There are 4 main methods of breathing, so let us examine them and see what they have to offer us. See what they are. The first method is a very poor one indeed. It is known as top breathing, because in this system, only the upper part of the chest and lungs is used, and that, as you should know, is the smallest part of your breath cavity. So, when you do this top breathing, you get very little air into your lungs, but you get a lot of stale air in the deep recesses. You see, you make only the top of your chest move. The bottom part of your chest and your abdomen are stationary, and that's a very bad thing indeed. Forget about top breathing, Lobsang, because it is quite useless. It is the worst form of breathing that one can do, and we must turn to others." He paused and turned to face me, saying, "Look, this is top breathing. Look at the strained position I have to adopt. But that, as you will find later, is the type of breathing done by most Westerners, by most people outside Tibet and India. It causes them to think in a woolly manner and to be mentally lethargic." I looked at him in open-mouthed amazement. I certainly did not imagine that breathing was such a difficult affair. I thought that I had always managed reasonably well, and now I was learning that I was wrong. "Lobsang, you are not paying much attention to me. Now let us deal with the second system of breathing. This is known as middle breathing. It is not a very good form either. There is no point in dealing with it more fully because I do not want you to use it, but when you get to the West, you will hear people refer to it as rib breathing, or breathing in which the diaphragm is kept stationary. The third system of breathing is low breathing, and while it is possibly a little better than the other two systems, it is still not correct. Some people call this low breathing abdominal breathing. In this system, the lungs do not get completely filled with air. The air in the lungs is not completely replaced. And so again, there is staleness, bad breath, and illness. So, do nothing at all about these systems of breathing, but do as I do. Do as other lamas here do, the complete breath. And here is how you should do it." "Ah," I thought, "now we're getting down to it. Now I'm going to learn something. Now why did he tell me all that other stuff, then say I mustn't do it?" because, Lob Sang, my guide said, obviously having read my thoughts, because you should know faults as well as virtues. Since you have been here at Shakpori, said my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, you have undoubtedly noticed that we stress and stress again the importance of keeping one's mouth shut. That is not merely so that we can make no false statements. It is so that one can breathe only through the nostrils. If you breathe through the mouth, you lose the advantage of air filters in the nostrils and of the temperature control mechanism which the human body has. And again, if you persist in breathing through the mouth, the nostrils eventually become stopped up, and so one gets catarrh and a stuffy head and a whole host of other complaints. I guiltily became aware that I was watching my guide with open-mouthed amazement. Now I closed my mouth with such a snap that his eyes twinkled with amusement, but he said nothing about that. Instead, he continued, "Nostrils really are very important things, and they must be kept clean. If ever your nostrils become unclean, sniff a little water up them and let it run down inside the mouth so that you can expel it through the mouth. But whatever you do, do not breathe through the mouth, only through the nostrils. It might help, by the way, if you use warm water. Cold water may make you sneeze." He turned and touched the bell at his side. A servant entered and refilled the tea jug and brought fresh sampa. He bowed and left us. After a few moments, the Lama Mingyur Dondup resumed his discourse to me. "Now, Lob Sang, we will deal with the true method of breathing, the method which has enabled certain of the lamas of Tibet to prolong their life to a truly remarkable span. Let us deal with complete breathing. As the name implies, it embodies the other three systems, low breathing, middle breathing, and top breathing, so that the lungs are truly filled with air, and the blood is therefore purified and filled with life force. This is a very easy system of breathing. You have to sit or stand in a reasonably comfortable position and breathe through the nostrils. I saw you just a few moments ago, Lob Sang, crouched over, absolutely slouching, and you just cannot breathe properly when you are slouched over. You must keep your spine upright. That is the whole secret of correct breathing." He looked at me and sighed, but the twinkle in the corners of his eyes belied the depth of the sigh. Then he got up and walked across to me, put his hands beneath my elbow, and lifted me up so that I was sitting quite upright. "Now, Lob Sang, that's how you must sit, like that, with your spine upright, with your abdomen under control, with your arms at your sides. Now sit like that. Expand your chest, force your ribs outwards, and then push down your diaphragm so that the lower abdomen protrudes also. In that way, you will have a complete breath. There's nothing magical about it, you know, Lob Sang. It is just ordinary common sense breathing. You have to get in as much air as you can, and then you have to get out all the air again and replace it. For the moment, you may feel that this is involved or intricate. You may feel it is too difficult, not worth the effort, but it is worth the effort. You feel that it is not because you are lethargic, because you have gotten into somewhat slovenly way of breathing, and you have to breathe discipline. I breathed as directed, and to my considerable astonishment, I found that it was easier. I found that my head swam a little for the first few seconds, and even in the few minutes, I felt better. I am going to give you some breathing exercises every day, love saying, and I'm going to ask you to keep on at it. It is worthwhile. You will have no more trouble with getting out of breath. That little jaunt up the hill distressed you, but I, who am many times your age, can come up it without difficulty. He sat back and watched me while I breathed in the way he had instructed. Certainly I could, even now at this early stage, appreciate the wisdom of what he was saying. He settled himself again and continued. The only purpose of breathing, no matter what system one adopts, is to take in as much air as possible and to distribute it throughout the body in a different form, in a form which we call prana, that is the life force. That prana is the life force which activates man, which activates everything that lives. Plants, animals, man, even the fishes have to extract oxygen from water and convert it to prana. However, we are dealing with your breathing, Lobsang. Inhale slowly. Retain that breath for a few seconds, then exhale quite slowly. You will find that there are various ratios of inhaling, holding, exhaling, which accomplish various effects, such as cleansing, vitalizing, etc. Perhaps the most important general form of breathing is what we call the cleansing breath. We will go into this now because, from now on, I want you to do it at the beginning and ending of every day and at the beginning and ending of every particular exercise. I had been following very carefully. I knew well the power that these high lamas had, how they could glide across the earth faster than a man could gallop on a horse, and how they could arrive at their destination untroubled, serene, controlled, and I determined that long before I too was a lama, for at this stage I was just an acolyte, I would master the science of breathing. My guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, continued, "Now, Lobsang, for this cleansing breath, inhale completely, three complete breaths. No, not shallow little things like that. Deep breaths, really deep ones, the deepest that you can manage. Fill your lungs, draw yourself up, and let yourself become full of air. That's right," he said. "Now, with the third breath, retain that air for some 4 seconds. Screw up your lips as if you're going to whistle, but Do not puff out your cheeks. Blow a little air through the opening in your lips with all the vigor that you can. Blow it out hard. Let it go free. Then stop for a second, retaining the air which is left. Blow out a little more, still with all the vigor you can muster. Stop for another second, and then blow out the remainder, so that there is not a puff of air left inside your lungs. Blow it out as hard as you can. Remember, you must exhale, in this case, with very considerable vigor, through the opening in your lips. Now, do you not find that this is remarkably refreshing? To my surprise, I had to agree. It had seemed to me a bit stupid, just puffing out and blowing out, and now that I had tried it a few times, I really found that I was tingling with energy, feeling perhaps better than I had ever felt before. So I puffed, and I puffed, and I expanded myself, and I blew my cheeks out. Then, suddenly, I felt my head swimming. It seemed to me that I was getting lighter and lighter. Through the haze, I heard my guide, "Lobsang, Lobsang, stop. You do not breathe like that. Breathe as I tell you. Do not experiment, for to do so is dangerous. Now, you have got yourself intoxicated through breathing incorrectly, by breathing too quickly. Exercise only as I am telling you to exercise, for I have the experience. Later, you can experiment on your own, but Lobsang, always caution those whom you are teaching to be careful to follow the exercises and not to experiment. Tell them never to experiment with different ratios of breathing unless they have a competent teacher with them. For to experiment with breathing is dangerous indeed. To follow the set exercise is safe. It is healthy, and no harm at all can fall to those who breathe as instructed." The Lama stood up and said, "Now, Lobsang, it will be a good idea if we increase your nervous force. Stand erect as I am standing now. Inhale as much as you can. Then, when you think that your lungs are full, force in yet a little more breath. Slowly exhale. Slowly. Refill your lungs completely and retain that breath. Extend your arms straight in front of you, not using any effort, you know, just to keep your arms in front of you, with just enough strength to keep them horizontal, but use as little effort as you can. Now look, watch me. Draw your hands back toward the shoulder, gradually contracting the muscles and making them tight so that by the time your hands can touch your shoulders, the muscles will be quite taut and the fists clenched. Watch me. See how I am clenching mine. Clench your hands so tightly that they tremble with the effort. Still keeping the muscles taut, push the fists slowly out. Then draw them back rapidly several times, perhaps half a dozen times. Exhale vigorously, really vigorously, as I told you before, with the mouth, with the lips pursed up, and with just a hole through which you blow the breath as strongly as you can. After you've done that a few times, finish by practicing the cleansing breath once again. I tried it, and I found it, as before, of great benefit to me. Besides, it was fun, and I was always ready for fun. My guide broke in on my thoughts. Love sang, I want to emphasize and emphasize again that the speed of the drawing back of the fists and then tension of the muscles determines how much benefit you can get from this. Naturally, you'll have made quite sure that your lungs are absolutely full before doing this exercise. This, by the way, is a truly invaluable exercise and will help you enormously during later years. He sat down and watched me go through that system, gently correcting my faults, praising me when I did it well, and when he was satisfied, he made me go through all the exercises again to be quite sure that I could do it without further instruction. Eventually, he motioned for me to sit beside him while he told me how the Tibetan system of breathing was formed after deciphering the old records deep down in the caverns beneath the Potala. Later, in my studies, I was taught various things about breath, for we of Tibet do not cure only by herbs, but we also cure through the patient's breathing. Breathing is indeed the source of life, and it may be of interest to give a few notes here which may enable those who have some ailment, perhaps of long standing, to banish or to alleviate their suffering. It can be done through correct breathing, you know, but do remember, breathe only as advised in these pages, for to experiment is dangerous unless there is a competent teacher at hand. To experiment blindly is folly indeed. Disorders of the stomach, the liver, and the blood can be overcome by what we term the retained breath. There's nothing magical in this, mind, except in the result, and the result can appear to be quite magical, quite without parallel. But at first you must stand erect, or if you're in bed, lie straight. Let us assume, though, that you are out of bed and can stand erect. Stand with your heels together, with your shoulders back and your chest out. Your lower abdomen will be tightly controlled. Inhale completely. Take in as much air as you can, and keep it in until you feel a slight, very slight throbbing in your temples to the left and to the right. As soon as you feel that, exhale vigorously through the open mouth, really vigorously, you know, not just letting it drift out, but blowing it out through the mouth with all the force at your command. Then you must do the cleansing breath. There is no point in my going into that again, because I have told you about that, as my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dandab, told me. I will just reiterate that the cleansing breath is absolutely invaluable to enable you to improve your health. Before we can do anything about breathing, we must have a rhythm, a unit of time which represents a normal inhalation. I have already mentioned it as was taught to me, but perhaps repetition in this case would be a useful thing, as it will help to fix it permanently in one's mind. The heartbeat of the person is the proper rhythmic standard for that particular individual's breathing. Hardly anyone has the same standard, of course, but that doesn't matter. You can find your normal breathing rhythm by placing your finger on your pulse and counting. Put your right hand fingers on your left wrist and feel about for the pulse. Let us assume that it is an average of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Get that rhythm firmly fixed in your subconscious so that you know it unconsciously, subconsciously, so that you do not have to think about it. It does not matter to repeat what your rhythm is as long as you know it, as long as your subconscious knows it. But we are imagining that your rhythm is the average one in which the air intake lasts for 6 beats of your heart. This is just the ordinary workaday routine. We are going to alter that breathing rate quite a lot for various purposes. There is nothing difficult in it. It's a very easy thing indeed, which can lead to spectacular results in improved health. All acolytes of the higher grade in Tibet were taught breathing. We had certain exercises which we had to do before studying anything else, and this was the preliminary procedure in all cases. Would you like to try it? Then, first of all, sit erect. You can stand if you like, but there's no point in standing if you can sit. Inhale slowly the complete breathing system, that is, chest and abdomen, while counting 6 pulse units. That's quite easy, you know. You only have to keep a finger on the pulse in your wrist and let your heart pump out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. When you've got the breath in after your 6 pulse units, retain it while your heart beats 3 times. After that, exhale through the nostrils for 6 heartbeats. That is, for the same time as that in which you inhaled. Now that you have exhaled, keep your lungs empty for 3 pulse units, and then start all over again. Repeat this as many times as you like, but do not tire yourself. As soon as you feel any tiredness, stop. You should never tire yourself with exercises, because if you do, you defeat the whole object of those exercises. They are to tone one up and make one feel fit, not to run one down or to make one tired. We always started with the cleansing breath exercise, and that cannot be done too often. It is completely harmless and is most beneficial. It rids the lungs of stale air, rids them of impurities, and in Tibet there is no TB. So you can do the cleansing breath exercises whenever you feel like it, and you will get the greatest benefit from it. One extremely good method of acquiring mental control is by sitting erect and inhaling one complete breath. Then inhale one cleansing breath. After that, inhale in the rate of 1, 4, 2. That is, let us have seconds for a change. Inhale for 5 seconds, then hold your breath for 4 times 5 seconds. That is 20 seconds. When you have done that, breathe out for 10 seconds. You can cure yourself of a lot of pain by breathing properly, and this is a very good method. If you have some pain, either lie down or sit erect, it doesn't matter which, then breathe rhythmically, keeping the thought in your mind that with each breath, the pain is disappearing. With each exhalation, the pain is being pushed out. Imagine that every time you breathe in, you are breathing in the life force, which is displacing the pain. Imagine that every time you breathe out, you are pushing out the pain. Put your hand over the affected part and imagine that with your hand, with every breath, you are wiping the cause of pain away. Do this for 7 complete breaths. Then try the cleansing breath, and after that, rest for a few seconds, breathing slowly and normally. You will probably find that the pain has either completely gone or it has lessened so much that it doesn't bother you. But if for any reason you still have the pain, repeat the same thing. Try the same thing once or twice more until eventually relief comes. You will, of course, quite understand that if it is an unexpected pain and it recurs, you will have to ask your doctor about it, because pain is nature's warning that something is wrong. And while it's perfectly correct and permissible to lessen pain when one is aware of it, it is still essential that one does something to find out what caused the pain and to cure the cause. Pain should never be left untended. If you are feeling tired, or if there has been a sudden demand on your energies, here is the quickest way to recuperate. Once again, it doesn't matter if you're standing or sitting, but keep your feet close together, toes and heels touching. Then clasp your hands together so that your fingers of each hand interlock, and so that your hands and feet each form a sort of closed circle. Breathe rhythmically for a few times, rather deep breaths, and slow in the exhaling. Then pause for 3 pulsed units, and next do the cleansing breath. You will find that your tiredness has gone. Many people are very, very nervous indeed when going for an interview. They get clammy palms and perhaps shaky knees. There's no need for anyone to be like that because it's so easy to overcome. And this is a method of doing that while you are perhaps in the waiting room, possibly at the dentist. Take a really deep breath, breathing through your nostrils, of course, and hold that breath for 10 seconds. Then exhale slowly with the breath under full control all the time. Allow yourself to take 2 or 3 ordinary breaths, and then again inhale deeply, taking 10 seconds to fill your lungs. Hold the breath again and exhale slowly, again taking 10 seconds. Do this 3 times, as you can without anyone noticing, and you will find that you are absolutely reassured. The pounding of your heart will have stopped, and you will feel much strengthened in confidence. When you leave that waiting room and go to your place of interview, you will find that you are in control of yourself. If you feel a flutter or two of nervousness, then take a deep breath and hold it for a second or two, as you can easily do while the other man is talking. This will reinforce your flagging confidence. All Tibetans use systems such as this. We also use breath control when lifting, because the easiest way to lift anything, maybe furniture or lifting a heavy bundle, the easiest way is to take a really deep breath and hold it while you lift. When the actual act of lifting is over, then you can let out your breath slowly and continue to breathe in the normal way. Lifting while you hold a deep breath is easy. It is worth trying for yourself. It is worth trying to lift something fairly heavy with your lungs full of air and see the difference. Anger, too, is controlled by that deep breathing and by holding the breath and exhaling slowly. If for any reason you feel really angry, either justly or otherwise, take a deep breath, hold it for a few seconds, and then expel that breath quite slowly. You will find that your emotion is under control, and you are master of the situation. It is very harmful to give way to anger and irritation, because that can lead to gastric ulcers. So, remember, this breathing exercise of taking a deep breath, retaining it, and then expelling it slowly. You can do all these exercises with absolute confidence, knowing that they just cannot harm you in any way. But a word of warning: keep to these exercises. Do not try anything more advanced except under the guidance of a competent teacher, because ill-advised breathing exercises can do quite a lot of harm. In our prison camp, we had our prisoners breathe like this. We also went far more deeply into the matter and taught them to breathe so that they would not feel pain, and that, allied with hypnosis, enabled us to do deep abdominal operations and to amputate arms and legs. We had no anesthetics, so we had to resort to this method of killing pain: hypnosis and breath control. That is nature's method, the natural way. End of chapter 10.